from that experience after what happened when I left Eve at the beach to meet Jeremy. I didn't desire another man until I met Aiden. I mean, I've had plenty of lovers, and they served a certain purpose. But it's not the same, is it? In Aiden, I felt a different kind of lifeline. I truly believe that our years in New York had been good, that I had stopped running. It wasn't just the financial security. I could have kept working at my job and achieved that on my own. It was the way Aiden treated me, never wavering in his adoration, his encouragement, his expressions of love. He said he'd learned his lesson from his first marriage and the things his ex-wife said to him when she asked for the divorce, how she felt unseen, unappreciated, unloved. He said he would never let that happen again. We shouldn't have moved back to East Bay. I can see how that lifeline got yanked away. Aiden betrayed me in asking me to come here again. That's the truth. I never spoke to him about Eve, at least not in any meaningful way. But he knew about my mother. He knew what my therapist had said about her, talking about the same diagnoses I used to give her in high school. She was somewhere on that spectrum. They don't call it access to anymore, but the illnesses are the same. She's a narcissist, most likely, but in any case, lacking empathy, incapable of real love, especially for a daughter. Aiden certainly knew about Tyler and the troubles she caused him. I know I haven't told him how I feel being back here, but I think he should know. I shouldn't have to say it. Oh, God, maybe that's unfair. I went to the Four Points that Tuesday night, desperate for the new lifeline that David had offered me, the one I now needed because Aiden's was gone and I was again running from my past. So on that Tuesday night, I pulled into the strange gravel parking lot and parked in an empty spot close to the road. I walked toward the small signs where the woods began. I had read everything about this place at the library. I knew what to do, how to look for the arrow with the name of the room, Garden 3, and follow the path that led to its doorway. I got to the door and saw it open a tiny crack. I went inside, my heart pounding in my chest, so filled with longing and desire I wanted to cry. And then I saw him standing in there, dressed in jeans and a loose button-down, the sleeves rolled up. His hands were in his pockets, and he just looked at me with the same expression that I imagined to be on my face. Like, what are we doing? But also, what have we found? I closed the door and stepped inside a few feet. I put my purse down on a table and then stood still with my arms at my sides. We stared at each other from this distance, neither of us knowing what to do with the energy between us, the desire. Finally, he walked slowly toward me and again put his hands on my face and pressed his lips against mine. It was the same kiss we'd had by the river, only this time it didn't end there. Moving just as slowly, just as deliberately, as though every touch needed to be seen to its completion, every stroke of my skin, the way he slipped my dress up and over my head, his hands finding the small of my back along the way, then around my ribs to my stomach and up to my... You get the point. I've slept with enough men to know the degrees of intimacy and skill. The ones who want to make it salacious right from the start, tell you to take off your clothes, play the sexy stripper, or the ones who have to tear them off like they can't wait another second to throw you on the bed and get inside you. Some men touched me like I might break, scared, like they were little boys lost in a forest. Eve used to talk about men and boys, how some men still had the boy inside them and how some boys were already men. And I think that's true. Although I could never see through them the way Eve could. Not until I had them alone in a bedroom. That was when I knew, the way they behaved during that first encounter. No one ever got it quite right. Aiden was so mature about our intimacy, always asking what I wanted, what I needed, asking me if things felt good, if I wanted him to be faster or slower. It started to feel like a task we were completing, hanging a new painting on the wall, setting the table for a dinner party. Not unpleasant. I could always get there somehow by the end. Aiden is definitely a man inside. But this was something different. I don't know if David knew a thing about my life. He said he'd read my book, the one about the missing girl, but we met before he'd read it, and I knew so little about him. I'd searched everything I could think of at the library and found nothing. David Paul. Two first names make it hard to search. He said he worked in IT, so he knew how to avoid having a digital footprint. And why did he want to do that? What had happened to him in his past? Damaged people find each other. I kept thinking about that. Whatever it was, we didn't speak again until it was over. Until we'd made love for nearly 2 hours, his skin against my skin, his mouth, his hands, like a sexual composition that had been written just for me. I don't have words to describe it to you. He read my body and my mind, and for the first time in my life, I never wanted it to end. When he, you know, finished, I didn't even know it. He just rode it like a wave, then continued to play the next bar of the score. And with everyone, I felt the lifeline gripped in my hands. This was what I needed, this encounter with a practical stranger at the Four Points Hotel, hidden away in the woods by the river after lying to my husband and knowing he'd lied to his wife. This sinful, adulterous encounter was the very thing that I needed to save my marriage. But I swear to you, that night when we heard the sounds, it was going to be the last time. It's not that the feelings had worn off or become something I no longer wanted. I just realized there was no place to go. I couldn't keep doing this to Aiden. It was not a solution I could maintain. Like I said before, I knew that this escape was the ruin. I'd begun to think of it as a wake-up call that I needed to tell Aiden that we needed to move anywhere but here. I was terrified that this would break his heart, that he would feel I had betrayed him, not because of David. I hoped he would never learn about that, but because I had been pretending to be happy. The same way Eve lied to Connor. God, I remember that now. How he found out about Luke at senior prom. What a disaster. I used to wonder, what if he'd never found out and they'd been together that night on the 4th of July 15 years ago? If maybe things would be different. Hiding is destructive, and I'd been hiding from Aiden. I had to end the affair and then tell Aiden how I felt. I had to stop hiding. When David and I met this last time, I was going to tell him it had to end, even as I stood there naked, with my back to the door, knowing I would have to have him first. I was determined. But then we heard the sounds in the room next door. And David went to see what had happened and never came back. I've messaged him on Signal 16 times, but he still hasn't replied to any of them. I took a screenshot of the messages I sent, just in case. I've spent hours back at the library searching his name again. David Paul. Still, nothing comes up that's him. I won't lie. The silence is scaring me. I don't know what happened when he left the room. I just know that was the last I've seen or heard from him. I don't know if he's dead or alive, and I'm not just being dramatic. And now my mind swings. Fearing that something bad has happened to him, or that he saw something in that room. And then I miss him. I want to hold him and help him through this. But then I tell myself that even if I do find him, it's still over between us. Fuck. I need to get out of this place. Out of East Bay. Before I lose my mind. Okay, Carrie. That's it. That's everything I know.
Jesus, Brooke. What have you gotten yourself into?
Chapter 11. Carrie, July 1st, 2025. My head was spinning as I stood on the dock, thinking about the party on the beach 15 years ago, and how there was no way this was a coincidence. I stared at the name on my phone, the woman who rented the room next door to Peter Walsh, Candace Kane. And I hear Brooke Lowry like an echo.
What about you? Will you tell us your name?
I'm Candace Kane.
I left Rob next to the fishing boat with the stench rising from the deck and the dead body entangled in the net, baking in the sun. There was nothing more I could do to help. The forensics team was setting up a tent, The ambulance was waiting to take Peter Walsh away when they were done. Mr. Lowry had the guests under control. I told Rob I was going back to the station to make more calls. But really? What I needed to do was see the woman who rented the room next door to a possible crime scene. Brooke Lowry. And now we've been here for over an hour, parked on a dead-end street in her BMW SUV, as I've listened to her story about what happened in the room next door. The affair with her lover David Paul. And now, her despair that she hasn't seen him since they heard the sounds in the room called River 3.
He's gone. I just have to accept that. Maybe if he knows what's happened, he'll answer me. Let me just try him. David, it's me again. We need to talk. Please, something's happened and I need to know that you're okay. You have to call me back, or text, or email, whatever, anything. David, I wouldn't ask if it wasn't urgent. Please. I told you he wouldn't answer. It's been 7 days. Here, look at the messages and calls I've made, with zero reply.
I look at the screenshots of the log on her Signal app. Screens and screens of desperate texts with exclamation points and question marks. Emojis of scared faces and hearts. Little yellow heads exploding. She and David Paul may have heard the crime that led to Peter Walsh's death. She doesn't seem to understand how much trouble she's in.
Brooke, the man in that room is dead. Forensics is with the body right now, and there was a wound on his neck. There's a strong possibility someone hurt him.
Maybe it happened someplace else. I mean, that's possible, right? I mean, if he was killed in that room and dumped in the river, wouldn't his car still be there?
It won't be that easy. What if he didn't drive there? Maybe whoever killed him moved his car. Maybe they drove there together.
Okay, I know.
What time did you hear the sounds, the voices?
Around 9.
Okay. So, where could he be, David Paul?
I don't know. I told you, you can see. I've been trying to find him for days, Carrie.
And the name of the dead man, it doesn't mean anything to you? Peter Walsh?
No.
What about his wife, Renee Walsh?
No, I swear I have never heard of either of them.
Is there a chance David Paul knew Peter Walsh? Is there any connection at all?
Oh my God, I mean, I have no idea. I mean, they're both from Rhode Island, right? But what does that mean? What are you saying?
I'm saying these are the kinds of questions that you'll be asked. And David Paul, when we find him.
If David knew this man who was killed, that would be crazy.
Maybe. But he's going to have to tell us that. And confirm what you've said. What you heard. Jesus, Brooke. I mean, seriously? You had to use that name?
I know. God, it was so stupid. I know. I never thought anyone would care who rented that room. Except maybe my husband, if he found out. It just popped into my head when I was making the reservation because I knew I wouldn't forget it.
You used it that night at the beach.
I know. But I never mentioned that incident to Aiden, okay? I thought it was... I don't know, it was coming full circle. The feelings I had back then, and now. Using that name reminded me of it.
Well, I remembered it. And now you're probably the last person who heard Peter Walsh alive. We're going to need David Paul to corroborate. And also confirm that neither of you saw him or anything else that might be useful.
Well, you have to help me find him then. I have told you everything I know, what he looks like, and that he drives a blue BMW with Rhode Island plates, and, you know, that he was from Providence, and he's married and has 2 little girls. He works in IT. He spoke to me about some of his clients, okay? He has his own company, so, like, maybe he must have licenses, right? Something like that?
Look, I'm sure he's just as scared as you are. If he went to that room and saw something, maybe he didn't want you to be involved. It could be that simple.
God, Carrie. I was just about to end things. I was going to tell Aiden I wanted to move back to New York. I was determined to save my marriage. You know what it's like for me here. With my mother. And these memories of Eve.
Look.
And Tyler. I mean, God, you know what he went through.
Yeah. I was here, Brooke. I see your brother almost every day. And that scar.
I know.
Okay, let's just, let's focus on what's happening now. We need to find the man you were with. Text me that description of him and everything you remember about his family, his background, his parents, anything at all we can use to search.
Okay. Carrie, I know you don't owe me anything. You just give me a few days to tell Aiden. I mean, maybe you'll find David before then, and if you did, would he even have to know?
Brooke, I can't do that. You have to give me a statement, and then we have to verify it. Aiden will have to confirm that you were out that night, when you came home, even if he was asleep on the couch.
Okay, but just maybe 2 days. 2 days then, okay? I'm such a mess, Carrie. If he leaves me and I'm alone here, I know that you hate me for what I did, okay? The way that I lied about that night.
It's not like that, Brooke. You were like a sister to me.
Yeah. You, me, and Eve. I thought we would be friends forever.
Me too. Okay, look. I can't promise anything. I have to get to the hotel and meet forensics. I'll put one of my people on the search for David Paul, but you need to get your life in order. Be ready to tell Aiden. I have to write up the report of our interview, and the best I can do is... I'll wait to file it, okay? I leave Brooke in her car, her face streaked with tears. 15 years have gone by, but she looks just the same to me. She looks exactly the same. I text Rob that I'm on my way to the Four Points. Forensics is done with the body and meeting me there. Right now, the focus will be on the room Peter Walsh rented, River 3. But it won't take long for them, for us, to begin the inquiry into the woman who rented the room called Garden 3. Candace Kane, Brooke Lowry. I drive to the interstate, get on the entrance ramp headed north. It's just one exit to the town where the Four Points is located. I can't believe any of this is happening. My phone rings, and I sigh, frustrated by my indecision. How far do I need to go to help Brooke Lowry? When I answer, it's not Rob asking where I am. It's Jamie, telling me he was able to decipher more words from the message. And when he says them, I see Peter Walsh tangled in the fishing net. And then the body that washed up on the beach in mid-August, 15 years ago. Eve Shea went missing on the 4th of July. Her clothes were found in a pile on the beach north of the pier, where she was last seen. Her steps were retraced, from her house where we got ready for the bonfire, me, Brooke, and Eve, and then parking in Connor's driveway, walking over the dunes, talking to some entitled jerks who'd come down from the inn. And how I'd stormed off after that. And then Brooke left to meet Jeremy Ashbourne, though she lied for weeks, trying to cover for him. Lisa Calder convinced Eve to go with them to the pier, and her father, Lee Shea, confirmed that he was on the beach looking for his daughter, angry that she'd lied to him about staying at Brooke's that night. But not too angry. Not angry enough to hurt her. Neither was Connor Rosario or Luke Kendrick, who were both at the pier and inside the arcade with Eve, but who both had alibis for the rest of the night. The pier had made the investigation a nightmare. A swarm of teenagers, stoned employees at the food stands and inside the arcade, a few of the homeless on the benches. Eve was there, and then she was gone. Everyone had a story about that night. I can still feel the fear mixed with hope. Desperate hope that she had run away. That maybe she'd had a fight with Luke or Connor or her father, even. Maybe they lied when they told their stories about that night. And then the news that spread through town like a brush fire. A girl's body on the beach. It had been in the water for weeks. The body of Eve Shea. Whatever hope I'd clung to while we waited for Eve to be found turned to grief that filled every cell. The grief that lives inside me to this day. The case never solved, ruled an accidental drowning. Now these words have been deciphered from the anonymous tip. The same words that have been screaming in my own head all this time. The reason I can't put her case to rest. Because part of me always knew.
Her name was Eve Shea. I suspect she was murdered.
Part 2. Chapter 12. Eve, July 4th, 2010. Brooke's kiss lingered on my mouth as I piled into the car with Lisa Calder, Bryn Ellis, and four other girls. Two in the front and five of us in the back. Lisa was drunk off her ass, but I needed to get away from the beach before my father found me. Brooke had left to meet Jeremy Ashbourne as planned, but my plans would have to wait. We got to the pier around 10:30. It was already packed with kids. I recognized many of them from the beach party, but also ones here for the summer, gathered in small clusters. Siblings on a family vacation, or here for the summer at their second home. Others seemed older, maybe college age, holding roadies of mixed drinks in plastic cups, beer cans hidden under cozies. But the two guys working behind the prize desk were too busy to care, weighing red paper tickets and handing out plastic toys and dusty stuffed animals. The girls from Lisa's car scattered into the social groups they'd clung to when we were still in school. I found a space near the back where I could sit against a wall and check my phone. I felt so guilty about my father. He knew that I had lied about staying with Brooke that night. I told myself that I would explain everything when I got home. Not the truth, but something he could believe about where I'd been. But for now, I was stuck in the stupid arcade, watching my classmates in their shorts and tank tops, sandals and baseball caps. The makeup on the girls faded and smeared, hair windswept and coated with sand and salt from the ocean, as they watched each other play pinball and Pac-Man. I could hear someone puking in the bathroom beside me. No one cared that I was sitting on the floor, thinking about what to do next, how to get to where I needed to be, 2 miles north to the East Bay Inn. I began to plot different ways to get there that would avoid the beach and the access road. If my father was still looking for me, that's where he'd be. And then I heard a voice I knew so well, and in all of its ranges. When he was calling to me from the hallway at school as I stood at my locker, or whispering in my ear as we lay naked in each other's arms. Connor Rosario. The girls in the car told me he would probably be here, that some other kids who'd been at his house to watch the fireworks said they were all meeting at the pier. We hadn't spoken since senior prom, since he'd called me all those names. And he'd been right to. What I'd done was unforgivable. I didn't plan to break his heart. Connor was everything I should have wanted. He loved me, and I loved him back in my own way. When I was younger, my mother spoke to me about growing up in terms she thought I could understand. Some of the conversations have faded over time. The message still there, but the time and place gone. The context, even the look on her face. Memory is selective like that. I didn't know that I wouldn't have a lifetime of moments with her, that each one was precious. But one of the times she spoke about men, or boys, actually, because I was only 11 at the time, I remember every detail. We were in the kitchen. She was making dinner and I was doing homework at a small table in the corner. She didn't begin the conversation that day with small things, like, how was school, or do you need help with your work? No. She just started to talk about how boys and girls were on opposite sides of a highway, how I would always be headed in one direction and the boys would be headed in the other. She said it was so easy for a girl to stop her car, jump the rail and get in the passenger seat with a boy. And then she'd be stuck, driving along his road the other way from where she was headed. I remember looking up and waiting for her eyes to find mine. And when they did, she said,
"Don't get out of your car, Eve. Not for anyone."
Her words from that day would stay with me. As the years passed and the world around kept changing, I saw the highway divide. The two lanes, the opposite directions, and the guardrail I was determined not to jump. But Connor was different. He didn't expect me to come to the football games and watch him play, cheer him on with the rest of the girls. He didn't expect me to hang on his arm as we walked around school or wait for him to finish practice so we could go home together. It was nothing like that. On our very first date, not far from the pier, we walked to the beach, and he asked what he could do for me. What would make me want him as my boyfriend? I felt like maybe we had somehow managed to ride together, side by side, in the direction we both wanted to go. And then I let him believe that I was in love with him, and that he was my first. I never told him I'd been with Luke Kendrick, but I had a good reason. At least that's what I told myself. Luke and Connor were rivals on the varsity team, both of them looking for the spotlight with the college recruiters. Connor didn't need any help paying for college, but Luke did, and that did something to him inside. He was desperate to get out of East Bay, and in his mind, Connor Rosario was the only person standing in his way. We worked together that summer at the East Bay Inn. Luke was a valet, and I was on the reservation desk for the first time. Both of us took night shifts at the restaurant. I'd known him all through high school since I moved here. He was a big deal. A starting wide receiver, catching the passes that Connor threw. I never cared about any of that. Neither did Brooke or Carrie. But things changed during the summer when school got out and the summer people arrived. Whoever you thought you were during the year, all of that was leveled by the wealth that surrounded us. I remember the first day I started my job at the desk. Luke came right up to me before the morning rush started and said, "I'm taking you to dinner." I made some comment like, "In your dreams." He smiled and walked away, leaving me with this strange feeling in my gut. The next day, we had the same exchange, and the morning after that, and after that. They started to happen in the afternoons as well, Luke insisting that one of these times I was going to say yes. I fought it, but he got under my skin. I watched how hard he worked, how many hours he was taking on, and in the restaurant at night, I heard him talk about saving money for college and to buy a car. He made friends so easily among the year-round staff. He learned all of their names. He brought them coffee and made them laugh. And I started to think that maybe there was a good guy hiding under the total jerk he was during the school year. So one day, when he told me he was taking me to dinner, I asked, "What time?" He smiled so big, it tugged on my heart. He actually skipped as he walked away. And then he made the plans. That night, he got the chef to prepare takeout boxes of lobster, corn, and potatoes. He set up a picnic down at the beach just off the dock at the inn. He'd even grabbed a bottle of wine from the bar. Everyone helped him with his plan. And again, I thought, who is this guy? Staring out at the ocean that night, Luke told me about his father and how he had been a high school football player and how much pressure Luke felt to perform on the field. He told me that he didn't really like the sport, that he wanted to study history in college, maybe be a professor one day. I thought I even saw a tear in his eye when he described his father's laughter after he shared this dream with him. And there it was, the broken part of this boy that drew me in, a crack in his armor that I found irresistible. I could feel it then, how losing my mother the way I did in a violent accident left a space inside me for people like Carrie and Brooke, and now, Luke. What happened after dinner was probably as good as it gets for a girl having sex for the first time. I'd never had a plan like Brooke did, to find a summer boy who was here for a weekend and get it over with. I didn't think of things that way. Luke and I had connected over that dinner, and then I wanted to kiss him, so I did. And then I wanted other things, more and more, until I decided how the night would end. Luke was experienced, and he knew what he was doing. He lowered himself down on top of me in the backseat of his car. He moved slowly, stopping when I told him to, though his body was shaking. He waited until I told him it was okay. And then I felt his hands grab hold of mine, like I was saving him from something, like he couldn't ever let go. Before it was over, I felt a wave of euphoria. He made sure of it. I saw him a few more times before the summer ended. It was never the same. Whether the things he told me that night were real or total bullshit, they disappeared. His armor started to close up again. He never spoke of his father or hating football. Preseason started and he was all in. Anytime I tried to reach that other part of him, he grew quiet and then changed the subject. I was so confused. But then I thought about what my mother had told me. Luke and I were moving in different directions. I wanted to get closer to him, to know the parts of him that were vulnerable. But that's not what he wanted. And by the time school started, the Luke Kendrick I had fallen in love with that night was gone. Luke said he didn't care when I broke things off. He said we weren't really together anyway. It was just a summer fling. He started dating another girl in our class, then another and another until graduation. No one else knew, except Carrie and Brooke, and I even kept from them the worst part about it. That I still loved the boy he was that night, and sometimes I found myself hoping he would come back. And then came the disaster at prom, when Connor found out that I had lied the entire year, and did I ever even love him? My silence had been the final blow that ended things between us. Now, Connor was there, at the arcade, walking toward me as I sat on the floor, my back against the wall, hiding from my father. I stood up when I saw him, my heart beginning to race.
Hi.
Hi. How was your party?
Can we talk?
It's not the best time. Can I call you tomorrow?
What, do you have somewhere else to be or something?
It's late, and everyone's been drinking.
Look, I just really need to talk to you, okay?
And I will talk to you, just tomorrow, okay?
No, that's not okay!
I could smell the alcohol on his breath. His eyes were bloodshot. I told him again that I didn't want to talk and started to walk away, toward the entrance and the boardwalk. I had to figure out a way to get back to the inn. I didn't have time for this. He grabbed my arm and I yanked it away, but he reached for it again. I felt a rush of adrenaline. Something about this had set off alarm bells inside me. Connor was a big guy, but he had been nothing but gentle with me. I'd never seen this kind of aggression in him before, but alcohol can do that to people. When I looked at his face and his eyes, I didn't recognize him. I got away again and started to walk toward the entrance until I saw a group of kids just outside on the boardwalk. Luke was among them. Oh God. I felt Connor right behind me, like a shadow, making sure I knew I couldn't get away that easily. And then Luke saw me, his face turning from a look of surprise to a cruel smile. He moved closer to the glass door, the only way in or out of this place. He spread his arms wide, spanning the entire width of the entrance. Then he cocked his head, as if to say, "You'll have to get through me." There were kids all around us. What could either of these boys do to me? Fuck them, I thought. No one was stopping me from getting where I needed to be. Tonight, and for the rest of my life.
Chapter 13. Brooke, July 1st, 2025.
Okay. Okay. Get your shit together, Brooke. Carrie Hollis. Fuck, this is a complete disaster. I never should have used that name. It was so many years ago, I'd nearly forgotten about those stupid boys on the beach and how I kissed Eve to make them leave us alone. I must have used that same name a dozen times between now and then, in college and in the bars of New York City when some guy would come up to me and ask my name. I always told them it was Candace Kane. Some got it right away, others took longer to realize it was a lie. It was the first thing that popped into my head when I needed to make the reservation at the Four Points, and now there's a body washed up in a fishing net, right here in East Bay. The body of a man who was staying in the room next door. I pull out of Leroy Street and turn onto the access road heading home, making the calculations in my head about what I need to do next. I can't dwell on what's already happened. My stupidity, my bad luck at having this fall into the hands of Carrie Hollis, the one person who had heard me use that name. Why did I do that? I'm so stupid. I pull over to the curb between two houses and look out at the ocean. I can't go home, not in this state. Did I want to get caught? Is that why I did it? No. No. I had no way of knowing what would happen, That there would be a murder investigation in East Bay where Carrie fucking Hollis was the chief of police. Just like I had no way of knowing that they would find out I lied about the night Eve disappeared. Carrie's still pissed about that. I can tell. But she knows that I was just a vulnerable teenage girl and that Jeremy Ashbourne preyed on me. Carrie knew. Carrie and Eve. For the entire year, they listened to every little detail, what he said about my essay, how he would look at me sometimes when we were in our seats and he was standing up at the front of the room, always in his khakis and his button-down shirt. I don't even know how attractive he actually was. He couldn't have been more than 5'7", and he was already starting to lose his hair. But he wore it long, and that somehow made it sexy. I dreamed about running my hands through it. I told Eve and Carrie about all of this. I told them how the one time I'd had sex was enough to create the fantasies about Mr. Ashbourne. Only he wouldn't be like that summer boy who was so quick about everything. Jeremy would kiss me long and hard from the moment he entered me, pausing when he was so deep I could feel every inch of him. Okay, wait. Maybe I didn't tell them all of that. Did I? I can still hear his voice. And the words he said to me when we were alone about my writing. But I knew it was also about me. Just me.
You're gonna set the world on fire, Brooke.
Even if I did tell them all of that, and God, I hope I didn't, I need to forgive myself. I was so young, and I rode the roller coaster of his affection, then his indifference, and after an entire year of living in my mind, the fantasy grew into a complete work of fiction. I pull away from the curb and start to drive. Slowly. I knew what Carrie and Eve thought about him, and me, and us. Eve observed things about people they didn't even know about themselves. And Carrie, she could rip away the emotional facade of anything, see the scrawny bare bones that lay beneath every single dream we ever had growing up. I remember sitting on the pier one afternoon, slurping down soft serve cones. "It's not real," she told us. "I heard it's made with petroleum." Leave it to Carrie to ruin ice cream. They let me have my fantasy. Eve, because she knew I had to play it out, and Carrie, because she didn't think anything would come of it. But she was wrong. She didn't know about my plans that night. God, I remember Carrie storming off that night, and I wonder if maybe the reason she never spoke to me again after that summer was not because I lied to her about where I was going after the fireworks. I wonder if maybe she didn't speak to me again because of what happened at the fire. When I kissed Eve to make those boys leave us alone, she was jealous of our friendship. Yes, because we shared things with each other that we kept from her, and she knew it. The kiss was a joke to us, but to Carrie? Maybe it was a symbol of the ease we shared, me and Eve. Yes, I think, as I drive past the spot on the beach where we had the bonfire that night, that's why she stopped speaking to me. That's why she never forgot the name I used with those boys. Candace Kane. Who else would remember such a small thing? And I did tell the truth in the end. Well, part of it. After Eve's body washed up on the shore in mid-August, they did an autopsy and discovered that she was 6 weeks pregnant. They had a possible motivation for foul play then. Like maybe whoever got her pregnant didn't want that responsibility. No one volunteered their DNA, and they never had enough probable cause for a warrant. Still, everyone was pointing their fingers at the men and boys in East Bay who knew Eve. The younger ones she'd dated, Luke Kendrick, who'd been at the pier that night and stopped Eve from leaving the arcade, blocking the exit with his body, taunting her. Connor Rosario, whose heart she'd broken and who was inside the arcade. Someone saw him grab her arm. Then there were the older ones who'd taken her under their wing because her mother was dead and her father was never around, and six beers in whenever he was. Mr. Rosario was one of the men they questioned. He was still helping Eve with her college situation after she'd broken his son's heart, and who'd even let her park in his driveway the night of the fireworks. Mr. Rosario was incensed that anyone would think he'd been inappropriate with Eve, so he pointed the finger at Jeremy, who'd also been helping Eve, with her essays. Something she'd hid from me. Then Jeremy told the police about us. He had to. They had his EasyPass records and witnesses at his conference in Boston who said he left early that night. He told people he wasn't feeling well, but then he got in his car and drove straight to East Bay. When they checked his phone, there were multiple calls to my number the whole summer. That's when they knew I'd lied.
Carrie found out because her mother still knew the cops working the case, and she retaliated by telling the investigators about my father. I remember when the detectives came to our house, the small ranch in the woods next to the inn. It's true, my father was close with Eve. I envied their relationship sometimes. I would see him speaking with her at the front desk or in the restaurant. He would laugh in a way that he never did with us, even when I told him something funny. No. When he laughed with Eve, his entire body would lift up and nearly fall backwards. He would close his eyes and his mouth would open. And then it would come, this jovial ha 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 ha. Sometimes he would place a hand on his stomach like it was so funny it hurt. And the thing is, Eve wasn't funny. That wasn't her personality. She was insightful, yes, and I imagine that's what my father found so endearing. I won't lie that when Eve was gone and my father's grief passed, I felt like I got him back. But that night when the police came, I thought I might lose him forever. All because of Carrie. And now, what will she do, I wonder, as I make it to my house and pull into the driveway? Aiden will be inside at his desk. When he sees me, he'll get up and walk to where I am. He'll kiss me on the mouth and give me a hug. I take a very deep breath and let it out slowly. I do this again and again to settle my nerves. I don't know what makes me more uneasy. The fact that Carrie remembered that night on the beach, the name Candace Kane, or the fact that my fate is in her hands. My nerves won't settle as I stare at the house. I have to forget Carrie for now. I have to focus on the one task that must get done. Everything in life can be broken down like this into little pieces, tiny steps. We all want to brush over them, but they're necessary. Step one is over. I've told Carrie. Now, I have to do a search for David Paul, but I can't do that here, on my laptop, with our Wi-Fi server. Aiden will have to wait. I send him a text. Daddy needs me. Something's happened at the inn. I'll explain later. Love you. XX. And then I back out of our driveway and head down the access road to my parents' house at the inn. To my brother, Tyler, the one person who can help me.
Chapter 14. Eve, July 4th, 2010. There was another thing my mother told me about boys and men that didn't have to do with cars and highways. Things that sounded like warnings. Things I also remember as if she were here right now. She was wearing a blue pajama shirt. It had a V-neck and long sleeves, exposing her collarbones and a silver locket hanging around her neck. She took my hand and squeezed it. She said there was one difference between men and women that could never be changed, no matter what anyone tried to do about it. Might as well try to change the sky from blue to green. Don't ever forget, she said.
They will always be stronger than you.
I began to see these words everywhere, clear as day. Summer camp in sixth grade. The boys had started to tower over me, and their muscles had definition when mine were still soft. In eighth grade, I outran a boy in a race at gym, and he found me in the alley on the way back to the locker room. He threw me to the ground and held me down. I couldn't push him off as he punched me right in my stomach. I was faster, but he was stronger. It was there again in high school, after we'd moved to East Bay. In ninth grade, we were all still growing, but I could see the seniors fully formed. The boys' sports teams always drawing bigger crowds. The girls trying to match their power with short skirts, tight shirts, fake eyelashes. Appealing to the sexual desire that seemed to level the boys to their knees. But that was like bringing a knife to a gunfight. There I was, at the Cosmos Arcade, Connor Rosario behind me, his grip lingering on my skin, and Luke Kendrick outside, blocking the exit. Again, I thought, what were they really going to do? Connor had never hurt me, except with his words that night at prom. And Luke, no matter what he'd been saying lately, I knew we'd felt the same thing the first time we were together. It was some version of love, when he let me touch the pain that was inside him. We went the entire school year without speaking about it, but I knew it was still there. And then at prom, God, everything went so wrong. The empty hallway on the way to the bathroom, Luke following me, calling my name to stop me.
Eve!
To make me turn and see him standing there in his black tux, and with that look on his face that I hadn't seen for many months.
Eve, hold up!
Luke, what are you doing?
I need to talk to you.
He took my hand and led me into a classroom. Then he took my other hand as he turned to face me, holding them both to his heart.
I have to tell you something.
No, I can't be here with you. I protested, told him we couldn't be seen here together. Connor didn't know about last summer, and Luke had gotten the spot at LSU they'd both wanted. Division I football, a full ride. Connor would be fine. He'd been accepted to USC without football, and his parents had more than enough money to pay for it. But for Luke, this was the end of a long, hard road, and one he didn't even want to be on. I think I was the only person he'd ever confided this to.
No, please, I have to tell you this. I can't wait another minute. I've been such a dick.
It doesn't matter, okay? We have to get back. I pulled my hands away and started to walk toward the door. He stood in front of it, spreading his arms across it, blocking my path. I wanted to leave. I was terrified that Connor would see us together. But then part of me wanted to wrap my arms around his waist and press my cheek against his chest and force him to come back. The boy I'd seen that night the summer before. Luke.
Just hear me out.
No, Luke, not here. What if they find us?
I'm not going to LSU.
What?
I got off the waitlist at Bowdoin. I'm going to study history there. They gave me a scholarship, not for everything, but enough. I can work. I don't know. I'll figure it out.
I didn't know what to say. I didn't know he was applying anywhere else. He'd gotten the offer at LSU last fall. Everyone thought that was a done deal. Connor pretended he didn't care, but I know it bothered him. It's not easy to lose, even if you don't need to win. I felt so proud of Luke in that moment, but then another thought raced in. Have you told your father?
No, but I don't even care what he says. I'm free of him and fucking football and Christ, Eve, all I could think about when I got the email was you.
What do you mean?
Come with me.
What? That's crazy.
You could go to school part-time and we could share expenses. You could stay with me, Eve. I'm free of this place and I want you.
My heart was racing. This was too much and out of nowhere. I was dating Connor and working with his father on my financial aid and scholarship applications. Mr. Ashbourne was helping me as well with my essays, even though I knew Brooke would kill me if she found out. Luke was right. I didn't have the money I needed to pay for even a state school. My father had filed for bankruptcy 3 years ago, and that kept me from getting private loans. The loans from the government weren't enough to cover it all. I could work once I got there, but I needed to get there first. Come up with the money for first semester tuition, room, and board. I knew it was a long shot, and I couldn't deny how I felt about Luke, how my heart burst open as he held my hands.
Will you think about it?
Luke, oh my God.
I'll do anything. Please, just think about it.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah, okay. I'll think about it. I'm really proud of you. He swept me up in his arms, lifting me off the ground, and I kissed him. So hard. But then we heard the sound from down the hall.
Eve, you fucking kidding me?
My heart stopped. It was too much. I pulled away from Luke and ran, past Connor and through the doors to the gym. Connor yelled after me and followed me inside. So did Luke.
Eve! Eve!
Connor caught up to me, and just like the night at the arcade, he grabbed my wrist and held it tight. His face was bright red and tears were welled in his eyes. But it wasn't sadness. It was rage.
Eve! Eve, have you been fucking Luke this whole year?
No, I swear. Not since we got together. I haven't even spoken to him.
Okay, so then you were what? What, you were with him before? And you never even told me?
Connor, I'm sorry.
I tried to tell him that it was over before school started, and that I didn't think it mattered because I was with him and I hadn't cheated, not ever, not once. Luke was standing behind him, watching, listening, searching for my eyes to see if I'd changed my mind. But then he couldn't hold back any longer. The rivalry they'd had on the field for years was playing out right there, over me. But it wasn't about me.
She doesn't love you, man. I was her first, and I'm gonna be her last.
Luke, shut up!
What is he talking about? Is that true? Eve!
Connor, let me explain!
You're a lying slut!
Everyone stopped dancing and stood around us. Brooke and Carrie were at my side as Connor called me the most horrible names, and in front of everyone. Brooke let loose, while Carrie tried to calm him down.
Shut the fuck up, Connor! You don't get to call her that! You don't own her!
Connor, let's go outside and get some air.
And then Luke couldn't help himself, walking up to Connor like it was fourth and goal, and saying,
"Looks like I win again."
And that was it. Connor went after Luke, and within seconds they were on the ground, throwing punches. Some other guys from the team pulled them apart. I don't know what happened after that because Carrie and Brooke took me out of there, and Brooke drove us back to the inn, where we found an empty room and emptied the minibar. But even that was not enough to console me. I knew things with Connor were over, but I also knew I could never follow Luke anywhere. I loved that small part of him, but the rest, the way he spoke about me, the way he decided he would be the one to tell Connor about us, there were things broken inside him that I knew I could never fix. And it wasn't my job anyway. I needed to stay in my car, on my side of the highway. When I told Luke later that week that I had thought about his offer and that I was turning it down, he went right back to being a dick, just like that. And he hadn't stopped, right up to that night on the pier. I stood in front of him as he blocked my exit, just like he'd done that night at prom. I reached for his right arm and tried to pull it down from the side of the glass door, which was now propped open. I could hear the ocean beyond the boardwalk as he flicked his bicep, releasing my hand. I tried again and again, but just like my mother said, he was stronger. It's just the way things were. And I knew, as I felt the heat from Connor's body behind me inside the arcade and from Luke blocking my escape, that I was, for the first time in my life, in trouble.
Chapter 15. Carrie, July 1st, 2025. It's a 20-minute drive to the Four Points. I have 20 minutes to come up with a justification for why I'm helping Brooke Lowry, why I'm letting her get out in front of this situation, meeting her lover in the room next door to Peter Walsh. I can still see the body, smell the body in that fishing net, that wound on his neck, the onyx wedding band. One thing is clear as I pass the Shell station and get on the interstate. I can't tell Rob. This would end my marriage and possibly my career. My God, what am I doing? Her story of seduction, of desire, plays in my head. And I remember, that was how she justified her pursuit of our English teacher. It doesn't surprise me that she's convinced herself of the same things now. This undeniable attraction between her and her lover, David Paul. She added a new twist this time, East Bay and what it had done to her being back here. She knew I would be drawn to that part of the narrative, how Eve's death had impacted all of us. And then there was the undeniable damage Brooke's mother had done to her and Tyler. All of that is true. I get off the interstate, stop at a light, make a left, following the GPS. I can hear Rob in my head, walking me through my obsession with Eve, and her case, and now risking everything to protect Brooke. He would tell me that Eve Shea went back to the beach after leaving the arcade, that she went into the water to go for a swim, that she got pulled under by the current and drowned. He would tell me my obsession is just guilt that has festered for 15 years because I left her at the beach. And now I felt I owed her a piece of me, her file under my desk, her case embedded in the back of my mind. We've had this conversation so many times. He always asks me the same question. What would have been different if I hadn't stormed off? I would have left after the fireworks either way, and Eve would have done what she was planning to do, whatever that was. And Rob is right. Every single time I run through this in my mind, Rob is right. And the message on the tip line? Rob would say it was just a prank. If it's not, why didn't they say more? Like, for instance, who killed her? Still, something about the words they did say reach inside and grab hold of what I believed back then. Because I knew Eve. She never went into the water alone. She never went in over her knees. If she went into the water that night, I knew in my heart that she wasn't alone. Someone was with her. Because Eve couldn't swim. And now what? I ask myself as I get to the road that leads to the Four Points. What do I tell Rob about Brooke Lowry renting that room? Maybe it doesn't matter if I give her a few days to find her lover, David Paul, so he can confirm what they heard. Or if we find out Peter Walsh wasn't murdered, it won't matter what they heard or even saw. If that happens, we never have to tell her husband or David Paul's wife. And besides, with or without me, the forensics team will find the trail that leads to her. She wasn't that careful, paying with a Venmo account that links to her credit card, the one Aiden doesn't see. Rob never has to know that I helped her buy some time. All couples have their secrets. But then, I think, maybe that's just the thing that eventually does them in. The road leads deep into the woods, and I think now that there isn't a surveillance camera within miles of this place. No way to look for Peter Walsh's car coming or going. Finally, I see the sign for the Four Points and the van driven by the forensics team parked in the middle of the gravel lot. I'm about to turn into the spot next to it when I see a car already there. Rob's car. Then my phone pings, a text from Rob.
Hey, I'm here in the room. Where are you?
What the hell is he doing here? I thought he'd be downtown spinning the story before it became more than an accident. Before it scared the tourists away. I text back. In the lot. Be there in a second. I park and hurry out of my car to the edge of the woods. I see the signs for the 8 rooms carved into wooden arrows, all pointing in different directions. 8 separate trails. Peter Walsh rented the room with the balcony over the river, River 3, the 3rd duplex. Next to it is the arrow for Garden 3, the room rented by Candace Kane. And I picture Brooke standing right where I am, anticipating a few stolen hours with her lover, the escape from her big house with her trusting husband, who carefully tends to her every need. Too carefully. Or perhaps too cautiously. Afraid of losing her the way he lost his first wife. Escaping, too, the memories from that beach that, she claims, still haunt her. I follow the path through the woods that leads to a steep set of stairs, hugging the cliff that hangs over the river. I'm a little winded by the time I get to the landing, and then the room where Peter Walsh stayed, where he was, possibly, murdered. Rob meets me at the door and asks me where I've been, if I'm okay. And I lie, again telling him I had to make some calls. He studies my face, then nods and looks to the interior of the room, which has been turned upside down. The bed stripped of the cotton duvet cover, the crystal glasses bagged and tagged, the hard surfaces, marble and porcelain in the bathroom, the pine dresser and coffee table, streaked with black fingerprint dust. The cushions from the love seat have been pulled to the ground and now sit in a pile on the wide planked wood floor. Rob sighs, then tells me where we're at. As if it's his job, not mine, to be in charge of the evidence.